Whenever I hear the actual Easter story, I'm reminded that Easter takes a while to get where it's going. As Lindsay reminded us a few minutes ago, Easter goes to joy, and great joy at that. But before it gets there, there is confusion and anxiety and grief. We generally forget that. We forget that Easter begins while things are still dark, literally and metaphorically. Mary's in the garden near the tomb, weeping because she lost Jesus. Twice, actually. She's lost him once to death and once to wherever his body has disappeared to. And in some ways, I suspect the second was even more upsetting than the first. It's bad enough to watch the Romans punish Jesus with crucifixion for being a threat to them, but the anxiety of simply not knowing what had happened to him when she found the tomb empty on Sunday morning might have been even worse. Those of you who are parents may have had that nightmare about losing your child in a crowd. That actually happened to me. My son Liam was about 5 years old, and we were living in New York City at the time. We were shopping at a place called Chelsea Market, a renovated industrial site in downtown Manhattan with lots of shops and food stalls and restaurants and so on. And it's always very crowded. And as we were making our way through the bustling corridor between the shops, I glanced down to check on him, and he wasn't there. I pivoted to see if he was behind me, and there was just another New Yorker scowling at me for slowing down in the hallway. And I said his name, Liam, and pivoted in both directions, trying not to panic. Nothing. And realizing that he was not near me, I decided to throw caution to the wind and began to shout, "Liam, where are you, Liam?" I strode backwards quickly against the stream of shoppers like some kind of icebreaker going through the Arctic, saying his name louder and louder, "Liam, Liam, Liam!" And then I finally heard it, "Daddy, Daddy!" I pushed through a few people, and there he was, less than 10 yards from where I'd realized that he wasn't with me. And I ran to him, and I scooped him up in my arms and held him tight for a long time. And after a good while of clinging to each other, I asked him if he was ready for me to put him down, and he nodded. And I said, "But I would like to hold your hand the whole time we're here until we get out, okay? I want to make sure I never lose you again." And even though he was a kid that was born in New York and very independent and proud of that, he agreed. Can you imagine anything more natural in the world than holding on tightly to someone you love that you had lost, but it was now returned to you? In every movie or story or real life experience, when someone's reunited with someone they love who's been missing or presumed dead or just gone through some kind of life-threatening experience, they cling to one another in joy and relief and thanksgiving, often laughing and crying at the same time because of all the different kinds of emotions that they're experiencing. And above all of that, they are filled with gratitude that the nightmare that they've been living is over and that they can finally return to something like normal life, something like whatever they had before, that they intend to hold on to now more tightly than ever because they realize how precious it is. Now, all of that makes Jesus' reaction to Mary Magdalene when she finally recognizes him puzzling as he tells her not to hold on to him. Because Mary had lost Jesus. When almost everyone else stayed at a distance or ran away after his arrest, Mary stayed close. When Jesus was being crucified, only she and one disciple and Jesus' mother and aunt remained with him. And here, on Easter morning, Mary comes to Jesus' tomb before the sun has even gone up. And when she arrives, she finds something unexpected. The large stone sealing the tomb has been rolled away. And so she runs to Peter and an unnamed disciple described as the disciple whom Jesus loved, who are basically the two most prominent disciples of Jesus other than Mary herself. But this is not a joyful errand. She doesn't conclude from the open tomb immediately that Jesus is alive, but rather that someone's removed his body. They've taken the Lord out of the tomb, she tells them, and we don't know where they've laid him. And Peter and the other disciple, they run to the tomb to see what Mary is reporting for themselves, and they confirm that the tomb is empty, and then they just return to their homes, resigned to just one more loss. But not Mary. Mary doesn't go home. She stays near. She stays right where she is, weeping in the garden where Jesus is supposed to be. That grief that she's experiencing is then honored by the three persons whom she encounters in the garden, despite all three of them already knowing that Jesus has been raised from the dead. First, she encounters two angels who immediately ask her, "Why are you weeping?" Now, they don't ask her that in the sense of, "Why are you weeping? Because you shouldn't be." They ask it in the sense of acknowledging that her grief is real. And they don't try to talk her out of it, and they don't try to explain it away. They let her express her grief, and they listen with respect and sympathy. And so after receiving that gift from the angel, she explains she's weeping because someone has taken Jesus away, and she doesn't know where. And then she turns and sees Jesus, but doesn't recognize him. And Jesus echoes the angels, asks why she's weeping, honors her grief. Jesus doesn't pretend like bad things haven't happened, or that they don't matter because everything's turned all right in the end, because he's alive again. He gives Mary the opportunity to voice what she's feeling and experiencing, and only then does he call her by name. And she finally realizes who he is and what's happened. It might seem like a small thing to trigger such an astonishing recognition, simply saying her name. But calling someone by their name is one of the most powerful things we can do. You can hear someone calling your name through all kinds of interfering noise. That's how strong our innate response is to it. As a child, when you hear your parents call your name loudly and in that voice, you can hear it from far away. And you know that you're in trouble. And the only question is whether you're going to let them know that you could hear it that far away. And when I lost Liam in that market, my immediate response was to call his name over and over again, louder and louder, and to listen for him as the only person in the entire world who calls me Daddy. That is how we found each other again, through calling each other's name, recognizing each other, and holding tight to each other. It's only natural that Mary would have done the exact same thing. After all, she didn't lose Jesus for 3 minutes in a crowd. She lost him for 3 days to death itself. And then she thought she'd lost him again to some robber. So she must have held on to him because Jesus responds, "Do not hold on to me." Now, that might sound cold, with the wrong tone of voice. One of the older English translations of the Bible used to simply say, "Don't touch me," in this passage, which sounds incredibly insensitive under the circumstances. But that's not what Jesus is saying. The word that gets translated "hold on" here doesn't just mean to touch someone. It means to cling, to fasten, to grasp. It has the sense of holding something or someone in place, not simply touching them. Now, that's still quite understandable on Mary's part. Now that Jesus has shockingly, miraculously returned from the dead, she wants to hold him with her there. Hold on to what she has. The last thing she wants to do is to let him go and risk losing him again. Letting go is always a big risk, because who knows what will happen next. There's a wonderful scene about this in the animated film Finding Nemo, which is probably my favorite film that Pixar has ever made. If you haven't seen the film, first of all, go see it. But second of all, it's set among creatures on Australia's Great Barrier Reef, and it actually begins with a tragedy. Two clownfish have just laid their eggs when a barracuda appears and attacks, and it knocks the father, named Marlin, unconscious. And he awakens to find his wife and all of the eggs except for one missing. That one he names Nemo. And when the egg hatches, Marlin becomes an extremely overprotective father. He is constantly terrified of losing Nemo to even the smallest risk. Now, Nemo, as you might expect, resents this behavior, and he breaks the rules one day to swim well away from the reef to explore a speedboat that's anchored nearby. And he ends up being captured as a pet by a scuba diver. Marlin watches all this happen, and he's horrified, and he tries to follow, but the boat, of course, speeds Nemo away. And that then begins this odyssey of Marlin pursuing clues about Nemo across the ocean with a friend that he makes along the way named Dory, who's a well-meaning but pretty addled fish that tries to help him. And they go through many dangers and adventures to find Nemo, whom they eventually realize has been taken to Sydney, Australia. Now, at one point, the two fish, Marlin and Dory, get accidentally swallowed by a large whale, and they're trapped in its mouth. And there seems to be no escape. As time passes, Marlin begins to despair, but Dory claims to be able to speak whale. So she starts trying to ask their unintended host what's happening. The whale responds in whale, which means that nobody except maybe Dory can understand. But suddenly the water in the mouth starts to drain away. Dory claims the whale is telling them to move to the back of its throat, which Marlin concludes means it just wants to eat them. So as the water drains out, the two fish teeter on the precipice of the whale's throat. Marlin is desperately clinging to the whale with one fin and Dory with the other. She's hanging suspended in the air. The whale says something else and Dory looks at Marlin. He says it's time to let go, she yells. Everything's gonna be all right. Marlin stares back at her in terror and says, how do you know? How do you know something bad's not going to happen? Dory considers that for a moment and says, I don't. Marlin looks at her, and then down below her, and then at her again. And for the first time in his life, agrees to let go. And they plunge down into the darkness of the whale, only to be blown up out of its spout to freedom in the ocean again, right outside of Sydney Harbor, exactly where they've been trying to go. They are alive. Hope is revived. And the story is far from over. It's that promise that Jesus is giving to Mary in this moment. He is alive. Hope is revived. And the story is far from over. You see, the good news of Easter is not that things can finally get back to normal and that we can keep it that way if we just hold on to them tightly enough. The good news of Easter is that what we have accepted as normal is being remade and redefined into something truly good. Easter is not a happily ever after ending. Easter is a joy-filled and hopeful new beginning. Here in the garden with Mary, Jesus is just getting started. That is why he tells her, not to hold on to him. It's time to let go of him, he says. Time to move forward into the promise of abundant life that he's been making all this time. That Jesus came for all of us to have. An abundance that can't be contained or curtailed or diminished by any power or circumstance on the earth. Not even death itself. Jesus has much more to do, and his followers have more to do with him. Which is why he sends Mary forward as his first apostle. The apostle to the apostles, as some Christian traditions call her, because she is the first person to bear the good news of the resurrection to those who themselves become apostles. And the word apostle just means one who is sent. And the truth is, you can't be sent anywhere if you're too busy holding on to what you have. But how do we know? How do we know something bad isn't going to happen? We don't. The promise of Easter is not that something bad will never happen. It is much, much better than that. The promise of Easter is that no matter what happens, there is nothing, nothing in heaven or earth that can separate us from God's love, that can push God out of this world, that can keep the ultimate good that God is always with us and for us from happening. Christ's resurrection doesn't mean that bad things no longer happen. It means that they no longer get the last word. Easter is about Christ coming down into the very midst of this world in all of its beauty and all of its brokenness and receiving the worst of it through rejection and death and coming out victorious on the other side. So as we gather today to celebrate Easter together in person as a congregation for the first time in 3 years, I think we have a better sense of the power of that promise than many of us had. Because the truth is, there are bad things that have been happening. But the greater truth is that the seeds of resurrection have been sprouting up among us the whole time, and which we are invited to see and cultivate and harvest. If we let go of trying to hold on to what we have and embrace what God is giving unto us now, new life and new hope and steadfast love, more than we need, more than we can hold, more than we can even imagine. Because Christ is risen. He is risen indeed. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.